This is West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann. Tap water contamination in Flint was caused by lead that leached from city pipes. It wouldn't have happened if the water hadn't been so corrosive. But maybe you've wondered why cities used lead for drinking water lines in the first place, or why leaded paint and gas were common late into the 20th century. Stuart Batterman is a professor of environmental health sciences and environmental engineering at the University of Michigan. Stuart Batterman, welcome to West Southwest.
Good morning.
Could it be said that there was a lead era in the United States, a point where use of lead in everyday products reached a height that hasn't been seen before or since?
Well, lead has been used for millennium, actually, and the peak production had occurred roughly in 1975, and then with several bans on lead uses, it declined. But it's increasing again, mainly because it's used very extensively in batteries.
Really? Lead use is actually increasing again?
It is. And this is lead which is used in the lead acid batteries that are in vehicles, in emergency and backup power supplies, and other applications, mostly electrical like that. Lead uses are also quite common in construction materials, things like lead sheets. Lead is used in ammunition. It's used in some cable sheathing and a variety of other miscellaneous uses. But the vast majority right now is in batteries.
Is lead use in batteries an issue where you need to be worried about being exposed to that lead?
Well, it's mostly an issue in battery manufacturing and or any upstream processes like mining and smelting and in recycling. Half of the lead production in the country and in the world, for that matter, is use of recycled lead. And smelters have historically been quite polluting, producing lead out the exhaust stack, which has dispersed throughout communities. In the U.S., the best known case is the Doe Run facility. This is a town in Missouri, which was essentially highly polluted with lead as a result of smelting. And much of the town was declared a Superfund site.
Where do you find these lead smelters now? Do you find them in the U.S.?
No, most of the smelters, I think, have been shut down in the U.S. Now we have secondary metals producing, but they're not lead smelters. This has moved offshore to China, to Mexico in particular.
And in those areas, are there concerns going on about people's exposure to lead from those smelters?
There is. In the U.S., most of the exposure now is a result of things that we did in the past. Of course, with the Flint case, you're looking at lead pipes that were installed from, say, the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. We used lead-containing paint until the late 70s. We used a tremendous amount of lead in gasoline until that was eliminated and the phase out for that began in 1978. And the history of lead is fascinating. There's a very clear correlation between these uses and levels in people. For example, when we banned lead beginning in 78, you could see production dropping, the concentrations in air dropping, and the concentrations in children, which we measure as the best indicator of lead exposure, all dropping. These were so highly correlated, it's a great way to demonstrate the effectiveness of these types of controls.
I read that when leaded gasoline was in use, the amount of lead in that gasoline was something like 2 to 3 grams per gallon. That just seems extraordinarily high.
Yeah, that's roughly correct. And that was dispersed throughout our communities, and the lead would form particles. Those particles would settle onto the dust and soils. And so now in all of our urban communities, we have a background of lead-contaminated soil. And so this is a source which we're all exposed to, even now, 20, 30 years after that ban.
You also had people painting their houses with lead. That went on for quite a while. Lead paint, I should say.
That's right. Just one more point about the lead in gasoline, which is really fascinating, is it's been estimated that all of the children that grew up in the 50s, 60s, 70s lost about 5 IQ points from their exposure. And collectively, that's 100 million or more than that IQ points as a result of that exposure. It took a few more years to ban lead in indoor paints. We had restrictions on that and some federal action by the Consumer Product Safety Commission and others. Later in 1995, I think it was, we banned lead solder in cans that were, you know, used to store food. And the history continues. In the mid-2000s and 2007, the European Union, which has been ahead of us on lead reductions and restrictions, restricted the use of lead in a lot of electronics as well.
Now, it's my understanding that people had raised concerns about lead exposure and its potential to poison people long before the 70s and 80s. People didn't just wake up one day in 1975 and say, oh my gosh, lead is bad for you. I mean, there were concerns raised earlier than that.
Absolutely. I think the first article that I saw was a German article from the 1890s talking about some fatalities due to lead exposure. 10 years after that, there were a number of articles in English talking about lead exposure, even via pipes, as we saw with Flint. So we've known for well over 100 years about the impacts of lead. Those were deaths. We find that there is no benefit of having lead in your body. And so at much lower exposures, we still have a serious health effects. We know that it impedes neurological development, can cause retardation, kidney damage, deafness. Later in life after being exposed, there's a tendency for an association between lead-exposed children and incarceration rates and violence and so forth. So it's a very serious public health concern.
These days, for children in places besides Flint, what's the main source of lead exposure? Is it paint?
Yeah, most of the children living in older cities which use lead paint and which had a fair amount of traffic, what will happen is the soil and the dust will be contaminated with lead. If the building is not well maintained, you'll have flaking paint, for example, if you have water damage near windows and window sills. And that lead paint will peel off and little particles will get, flakes will be ground into carpets and floors. And children, of course, are exploring their environment and putting their hands into their mouth constantly, and so they ingest a fair bit of lead. Now, on top of that, if the child is not well nourished, then the lead uptake is increased. And so what we typically find is that in poorer portions of cities, that the number of children or the percentage of children with lead above the guidelines is tremendously increased. So it's interesting. In Flint, roughly 5% of the children tested to date exceed the federal or the CDC guideline. However, if you look at Detroit, overall it's higher, and in West Detroit, in one particular zip code, 20% of the children exceed the guideline. And that's really a result of deteriorated housing, which allows this lead dust to be in the interior environment, the exterior environment. And so these children just get a lot of lead exposure.
Looking back on the history of lead use and lead products, is it fair to say that there was a period of time where the detrimental effects of lead exposure were pretty well known, and yet there wasn't a lot of action? Or is that just the benefit of hindsight?
I would agree with that statement, that there was a concerted effort by the lead industry and allied industries to continue the use of lead, even though the data and the other professions and individuals called for its removal or its restriction. And this had started in the 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s even, with some very powerful players in the lead industry. For example, the Lead Industry Association, which argued and advocated on behalf of lead producers, the Paint and Varnish Association, which basically did the same thing for the paint industry. And these associations had very strong connections to code-setting agencies, to legislators and policymakers, and they argued for the continuance of this toxic material.
It seems as though in say, 1960, where you're, you know, maybe drinking water that came out of leaded service lines, you are driving a car that is using leaded gasoline, and you, you know, maybe have lead paint on your walls, that your general level of exposure to lead, even if you weren't eating the paint or handling dirt from the side of the road, it just must have been pretty substantial, pretty high.
That's right. And in fact, if you go back to 1970s, and we have had a national program to measure lead and other contaminants across the population, you would see at that point that half of us would have exceeded the old guideline for lead, which was double what it currently is. And so that lead exposure was ubiquitous. I mean, there's no other way to describe it.
And it's certainly gone down, you said, in particular, since leaded gasoline was banned.
That's right. Overall, it's gone down. But as I just pointed out, I mean, I can zoom in on portions of cities like Detroit and still find 20% of the children who exceed the guideline level. And a number of scientists are calling for that guideline to be further reduced. And currently it's 5 micrograms per deciliter of blood. Some want it to become 2. And we know there's no safe level.
If you were in charge of lead regulation and lead policy, what would you change? What do you think needs to change?
Well, that's a broad question. You know, in terms of public health, we certainly need better surveillance. We need more action in terms of the results of that surveillance, in terms of assessment of lead sources in homes and in the workplace, and we need remediation activities. More globally, we're producing, I think, something on the order of 8 million tons per year of lead. Much of that is recycled lead, but there's still major mines operating in the U.S. and China and Australia. I think these are the top three. And that is used to make a number of products, like I said, batteries, but also lead for architectural purposes. There's still a lot of lead in electronics. We have some miscellaneous uses of lead still allowed in paints. It's in ammunition. It's in a number of products. Eventually, all of that lead is going to get into the environment. And I think we should really consider substitutes for lead. And in the case of batteries, for example, lead is used because it's the cheapest material that can be used in that application. Probably it's not the highest performing material. And so, you know, we're really just using it because we're trading off the price versus the ultimate environmental impacts.
I was surprised to see a notice on the EPA's website that said we're reconsidering our federal rules about lead in small aircraft fuel. And I thought we didn't have fuel with lead in it anymore. But it sounds like there are some exceptions there as well.
That's right. That's actually a very interesting exception. And leaded fuel is also still allowed for agricultural use for tractors on farms and things like this. And if you are performing air monitoring, for example, near airports, you'll see higher levels of lead in the vicinity of some of these airports than you will further away. And so that exemption was given because the argument here is that lead is a bit of a lubricant needed to maintain the engines in some of these aircraft and some of the farm equipment. It's really just a question of time. That same argument was made for passenger vehicles, but obviously, you know, you go to the fuel station now, you don't have leaded fuel, your car runs just fine.
Stuart Batterman, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Stuart Batterman is a professor of environmental health sciences and environmental engineering at the University of Michigan. You can hear our full interview about the history of lead use and exposure at WMUK.org. This is West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann.